Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy Sun, your life lessons onto your journey, onto your purpose. And today I'm excited because I have a good friend, a colleague, and someone I've grown to really appreciate her wit, her sense of humor, and quite honestly, just watching her from a distance. 2 weeks ago, her husband was a guest on the podcast, Mr. Richard Nichols, and this week we welcome her, a wonderful couple, a power couple, I will call them, but more importantly, people who are down to earth and who recently did something very different, and we'll get into that today. But ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, I welcome to the podcast this week, Ms. Sonia Nichols. Sonia, good afternoon. How are you?
I am fine, Gerald. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm sitting here. I'm going to try so hard to be so serious, but as I was thinking about the title of your book, It's Easy Sun, I wanted to just add one more line and say, it's also, it's easy daughter.
It is.
Daughters need to be listening to this too. I got the sun and they hung the moon and the stars and I got a bitty baby, my beautiful daughter. And it's like, okay, boo, it's easy for you too. Just have to make the decision.
It is. And you know, I have a daughter myself, so I try to make sure that the context is known for the title of the book. But it's such a joy to have you on the show today, and I know this is going to be a lot of fun, and we're going to get into a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Your husband shared quite a bit, so we definitely want to get in to hear some of the backstories behind all of that. But like with every guest, I don't talk much. I just allow the guest to speak. I ask open-ended questions, and then based on responses, yes, sir, I'll ask another derivative question and we'll see where the conversation goes. So let's just jump right in. So tell us, who is Sonia Nichols and her grounding, her early years, family, growing up, and what drives and sustains Sonia Nichols?
Well, I have to tell you, Sonia Nichols is a wife. She's a mother. She is a complete lover of God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. I would say that Sonia, if she is your friend, she is your dear friend. She is your close friend. I don't believe I have very many enemies. Now, I say that as a joke. I may have some people that may not like me, but I'm not your enemy. I usually want to be your friend. Now, right, you make me your enemy, I can come with it. However, I don't meet very many people that I don't like. I think everyone has a story. I feel in some shape, form, or fashion, God has allowed me since being a little child that I could connect with people. I make friends very easily. Again, I don't meet a stranger. My grandmother likes to tell me the story that when they dropped me off at preschool and kindergarten, that I was the one kid that walked through the room and hugged every kid in the room.
Wow.
All the other little kids started crying. And so she said she was trying to determine, you know, I just felt like I wanted to make everybody comfortable. And I think, Gerald, one of the things that I try to do is, I believe, you know, a lot of times we all show up in situations where, you know, in some shape, form, or fashion, we may be uncomfortable. And I want to make sure everybody that's around me, you feel okay too. Mm-hmm. Because believe it or not, I might be a little uncomfortable too, but I just want you to know, if there was ever a safe space, I really do want to be your safe space. I really do want to be the person, if you're around me, you'll feel like it's okay to be around me. You're, whatever you want to say, it's safe around me. You can express yourself around me. Now, I know I tend to suck up all the air in the room. I have cracks and jokes for everything, and I don't know if that's just my way of covering up
any
of my own insecurities. However, I just want you to feel like I'm safe and okay to be around, and I feel like I've been that way, Gerald, my whole life, no matter where I was in school, from kindergarten, middle school, high school. I feel that people find themselves being very comfortable around me. I had some weird experiences growing up, and when I call them weird, I don't want to call them bad. My parents had me when they were young. My mother was the the 14-year-old who got pregnant. Mm. My dad was 18. And so as young kids do, they don't necessarily make the best decisions at that age. And so my mother and my father ended up being addicts. Mm. But God protected me that entire time because I had the best grandparents ever. My grandmother immigrated here from Japan. My grandfather married her during World War II. So they lived here in the States, and I lived with both my grandparents and my aunt and uncle. And my uncle was an Episcopal priest with the Diocese of Florida. And so I lived with my grandparents, who were entrepreneurs. They owned, get it, nightclubs and liquor stores. Yeah, right, in San Francisco. And my aunt and uncle, my uncle was Episcopal priest of the Diocese of Florida, and he actually ran for bishop of the Diocese of Florida. And so, you know, people are like, well, how did you make it between those two? And I tell people what you didn't realize is what they have in common is both, I would say both environments were about hospitality. So while my grandparents owned the nightclubs and the liquor store, they were very hospitable. They had people and friends around all the time. And so there was always entertaining. There was always camaraderie and fellowship all the time. Well, growing up also with my aunt and uncle, with him being a priest, there were always people in our homes. And so we were always entertaining, you know, yet birthday parties and weddings and consecrations and things like that, that you do in the Episcopal Church. And so that's always about hospitality and entertaining and making people feel comfortable. And so growing up in both of those environments, I really feel like they shape who I am, in that I could get along with some of everybody because it was important to me that everyone felt comfortable if they were in an environment, if they're around me. Mm. So I would say I do hospitality very well. I think that's one of my gifts.
You said something earlier that caught my attention, and then as you were coming mm-hmm. back to it, grandma. Grandma was the first one out your off your lips. And yes. Then you talked about the nightclub and the liquor store mm-hmm. and then the uncle and mm-hmm. the aunt. Mm-hmm. But grandma came mm-hmm. up first. Does grandma have a special place in your heart?
Ooh, you're trying to make me cry. Mm. Okay, I'm not going to cry.
Go cry, please.
But on the podcast. You can't see me. Messing up my makeup. Got my mascara just smearing. Uh-huh. Gerald, if I were to say my grandmother was the first love of my life. Mm. She was my first. She owned my heart. And so what's interesting, when my mother got pregnant with me, and she would share with me, that her first inclination was to tell my mom that she couldn't have me. Mm. She really wanted my mother to have an abortion because she was 14. She just thought she was too young to have kids. And the one thing I tell people why I'm so passionate about being a pro-life advocate is because my mother fought for me, mm. even at 14. And even in the face of my grandmother, who I just told you was the love of my life, and when they were at the hospital, Presidio Hospital, Letterman's Hospital in Presidio, San Francisco, when I was born and my grandmother was in the room, and, you know, my mother said she just remember being disprepared, her heart was wrenching, that they were going to give me up for adoption. She wouldn't have the abortion, they were going to give me up for adoption. And she said, as soon as I came out, she was like, she saw, it was like the heavens opened up, like there was a glow. She said it was a 180-degree turn, that my grandmother, like she said, she'd never seen her the way she saw her when I was born. And it's like my grandmother's whole life just like flipped. Mm. And she was like, oh, no, 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 no. That is my baby. That's my baby. That's my baby. That's my baby. And my grandmother and I had been thick as thieves ever since up until she passed back in 2008. She was my closest friend. Mm. And I knew it was that one person you could do no wrong. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of kids understand this one. It's with grandma. you can do anything. And Grandma was like, you are the best thing since sliced bread and ice cream. You're the best kid ever.
That's true.
I was that kid, Gerald. Yeah. Best thing ever.
The best thing ever since sliced bread, right?
Or, yes.
So you grew up in
ice cubes.
Yeah, you grew up in San Francisco.
Well, so I would say I was in both. So I was born in San Francisco. But once I got to about the fifth grade, I remembered my grandparents being very worried. And their concern was being in an environment where there is a nightclub and a liquor store. As you can imagine, the element of people that are around. Mm-hmm. And I guess they saw so much in me. They thought it would be best if I grew up in a more stable, wholesome environment. And they had this conversation with my grandparent, with my aunt and my uncle. And they were like, how about we let Sonia come stay with you all? Because we're clear there's something special about her. And, you know, you just know that's nothing but God, right? There's completely nothing but God. And so then I went to go stay with them. And so during the school year, I stayed with my aunt and uncle in Tallahassee, Florida. During the Christmas, let's call it a spring break, Christmas season, summer, I would spend in California with my grandparents. And so I was the kid that was flying back and forth all through the year between my grandparents in San Francisco and my aunt and uncle in Tallahassee, Florida. I remember flying Eastern Airlines. I don't know if anybody ever remembers that airline.
Eastern, yeah.
yes, Eastern. I used to fly Eastern Airlines. And I remember being one of the first kids that would fly by herself. I'm sure other kids did that, but, you know, I'm special.
Yeah.
I'm special. Only saw me. It was only me on the plane. And so I would fly by myself back and forth across the country all through the year between my grandparents and my aunt and uncle.
So your early education then was really in Tallahassee, Florida, high school and grade school, middle school. What was that like?
Yes.
Moving from grandma, the love of your life, and moving to Tallahassee. What was that like?
So the interesting thing, Gerald, living in California, people like to say a melting pot. It was more like a gumbo. That's where a different type of race and nationality. I got to see, because my grandfather was in the military, my uncles were in the military, all of their friends, they were all military men. They all had wives from all over the world. So I had an aunt from France, one from Germany, several from Asia, from Korea, and Japan. And so when I moved to town, so that was, you know, one type of education. Richard calls it the United Nations. My family was the United Nations of California. But when I moved to Tallahassee, Florida, that was the rudest awakening. It was a culture shock because I only saw black people and white people. No Asians, just black people and white people. And that was a culture shock for me, coming from an environment being in San Francisco where there was such diversity, coming to Tallahassee, Florida, where there really was none. You were black or white, and that was it. I had the beauty, however, in terms of being in the Episcopal Church, I was everybody's daughter. And so all of the men and women, they were my, you know, surrogate parents who raised me. I grew up on the campus of Florida A&M University, home of the mighty, mighty, fabulous strike Rattlers.
Yes, ma'am.
And yeah, okay, make sure everybody got that straight. Strike again. that community was so wonderful to me, in terms of the culture and the education, and it was where I realized I wanted my kids, when they grew up, to go to an HBCU. I guess I want them to have every experience that they can. And I want them to travel the world and go to all the different schools that they want to go to. But I knew growing up in Tallahassee and going to Florida A&M, it was called the Developmental and Research High School, started there, then went to Florida A&M for college, got my master's at Florida A&M. So I'm a I'm a rattler through and through,
mm-hmm.
but I knew that there was something about being at an HBCU that would allow my children for at least one time in their lifetime to be in an environment where they would be fully embraced and that everything would be about them, only about them, all day about them, until it is time for them to venture out into, you know, the rest of the real world. I was so nurtured at my HBCU, and I'm a big proponent of HBCUs. I think every kid should be able to be in an environment that's just about them, at least for one small part of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the HBCU experience and FAMU. You know, I'm a Bison through and through.
Yes, Bison.
Yes, sir. I am a Bison through and through. So as I asked Richard when he was on, given all that we're seeing today and your FAMU experience and growing up there in Tallahassee, being around the campus and just seeing all that's happening today in terms of education, higher education, your sons are Morehouse men, your daughter is a mm-hmm. Spelman graduate. So HBCUs are in your very DNA. So what do you think about them and what impact do they have today?
I think as I watch what's going on even in our country, what I am, I have to admit, personally excited to see is that people are truly beginning to understand the importance of that experience. I understand that when HBCUs were established initially, it was so Black people could have a place to go and be educated because they could not go to the white institutions. And while that initially may have been a negative thought for many people, I think it was one of the best things that they could have done for so many of us, because our perspectives on life are different. And I think people fail to realize, at an HBCU, we are a diaspora of people from all over the world. And I remembered my daughter saying when she got to Spelman, because she went to schools here in Charlotte, and she and my sons were always in the gifted and talented classes. And when they would get to those classes, they'd be just one or two of mm-hmm. them in their class, surrounded by all white kids. And she said she just remembered how isolated she felt. When she got to Spelman, for her, she was like, oh, my gosh, there was every kind of diverse person, not just Black person, just the diversity that is in our DNA, you know, with Black people being all over the world. And then you put all of that on a nice, tight-knit campus called an HBCU. And mm-hmm. when I see that she felt like now she has a so-called safe space that it's okay for her to grow up and be nurtured in, I am so excited for people even today realizing the HBCU experience is not to separate us from you. The HBCU experience is to just put our kids in an environment where they begin to understand globally mm-hmm. how they have affected things that have gone on in this entire world since the beginning of time. The experiences that each of us from all different corners of this earth are bringing to this one campus, and to see that, oh my gosh, Black people are way more diverse than what you would believe. I think it's also interesting to learn, you know, on the one hand where everyone thinks that, well, if you're Black, you're super liberal. Well, no, not necessarily. We are a big mixture of everything. And I wish people, I'm hoping as we're going through the times that we're going through right now, that people will begin to realize that we are not a monolithic group. Mm-hmm. And my kids were able to see that when they showed up at Morehouse and when they showed up at Spelman. With me being at Florida A&M, I mean, I knew that, you know, my you know, for us, it wasn't as global. I'm telling my age. We weren't as global as they are now. But for us, it was a big deal meeting the kids from Chicago, meeting the kids in New York. And, you know, people from like Beverly Anderson from Paducah, Kentucky. And, you know, Greg Gilmore, he was from Chicago. And, you know, I'm thinking of all of the different people that I met that were from places that I had never visited, that I had never gone to, and listening to them and what they the experiences that they would bring from their neighborhoods, and they brought it to the campus. You know, the kids that were from D.C., you know, they had their own kind of music. I'm about to mess it up.
Go-go music,
music, so, you know, it's just thinking of it. You know, if you were from Miami, you was from the bottom, and there was a certain tone to their music, and you know, just even that exposure was so grand for me to be able to see how diverse we really are. And so I have to admit, sometimes I'm sad for kids who don't go to an HBCU, and when they show up at a predominantly white institution, and then they'll make the comment like, well, they need a safe space. And I think I'm torn about that, because in my mind, I'm thinking, if you're going to the predominantly white institution, the idea is to integrate. The idea is, so now let's blend what you know about you and what I know about me, and let's see how we can build bridges, you know, towards one another. How can we allow our collective upbringings, our collective thoughts, our collective ideas, how can we bridge these things together and become this one cohesive whole group? And so I'm always, you know, kind of sad when I hear the kids don't feel like that. They feel isolated. And so I pray that they're able to find a way to kind of work through that, because I think being able to go to a PWI is a grand opportunity to build bridges. But I'm as I'm listening to a lot of the kids, some of them are not able to do that. Hence, I'm again so pro HBCU. I have loved the experience. I would never take that experience away ever. I encourage every child, every black child. You just gotta go. You've gotta go to an HBCU at least once in your lifetime. you cannot explain that experience. It's all of us that went to HBCUs, Gerald. We are all connected, right? And so it won't even matter which one you went to. As long as you say one black college, all of us are like, now we're gonna talk trash because Howard, y'all all right. Fam, you still the best, but y'all okay. You know, like that doggone Morehouse and Spelman. They think they so doggone special. I mean, they are. But they think they so special. Like, wait a minute now. Fam, you made you possible. Let me make sure I get my kids straight every time.
It's always funny to me how we pull out the history lessons. You know, it's HU, Hampton University, Howard University.
That's right.
I know this is going to be a lot of fun. So FAMU, you know, I've come down to Tallahassee several times when I was at Bison for MEAC championships and stuff. Beautiful campus.
Oh yeah. You missed the track star. You got that right.
And now you guys have this huge rattler that was just put outside of a building, a copper rattler. I need to see that at some point.
Oh my God! I can't wait to go back to
it's
FAMU.
It's huge. It's huge. Yeah. So. After FAMU, what happened at FAMU? You met Richard there at FAMU, but in terms of your time at FAMU, and tell us a little bit about that and how you went into your corporate career and what happened from there.
Well, all of us, I would say our largest clique of friends, we Richard and I were in the School of Business and Industry. So we all grew up either an accounting major or business administration major. I was accounting. And that was an experience in and of itself. Dr. Sybil Mobley, when she called us superstars, you couldn't tell us nothing. We were superstars. And so I got my degree in accounting, and then I realized, Gerald, I ain't want to be an accountant. I went and worked for Amoco Oil as an intern. I worked for Deloitte. Back then it was Deloitte passed into sales, but Deloitte as an accountant. And I realized, which was interesting to me, I am a salesperson. Mm. What I realized when I worked for those companies as an auditor, the auditors loved me because I could get documents from the client that they couldn't get. Well, I'm just going in. I've made you comfortable. We're having this cup of coffee, and I'm cracking jokes. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to ask for, I need da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yes, yeah, let me go get that for you. And they were like, we've been trying to get these documents for them for a year. How were you able to do that? I'm like, oh, no. But please don't ask me to do anything with those documents, but go get them for you. And so what I realized was everyone that I worked with in accounting always wanted me, because I could get into rooms that they normally couldn't get into. And again, Gerald, I felt like it just goes back to my upbringing in terms of I want you to feel comfortable. I'm not here for any nefarious reasons. I just want to be your friend. Let's just talk. Mm. And I could get stuff. But what we did realize, I am smarter than I give myself credit for, because then I decided to go work for IBM. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go be a sales rep for IBM. And IBM made me take this exam. So there's an entrance exam IBM would make their first-time employees take. And I guess it's to figure out, it's like an IQ test. It really was. To figure out just really where they were going to place you. Mm. And when they came back to me, they all looked at me. They were like, so do you know that you just scored off the charts on our exam? And I'm looking at them like, so what does that mean? I just thought you wanted me to take a test. They were like, you're actually really smart. Now, everybody else would be offended by that comment, right? Not that I didn't think I was smart, but I'm not offended that way. Most people are easily offended. I'm just not. Like, you thought I wasn't smart, boo. Let me tell you a thing or two. And they were like, no, like, really, you're like really, really smart. We want you to instead be a systems engineer. Mm. Like, what does that mean? A systems engineer? They were like, I'm like, that's the technical person. That's the person that puts the networks together. And they were like, yeah, you're actually that person. Like, oh, man. Well, what ended up happening was I ended up qualifying for IBM as one of their first marketing reps/salespeople. Mm. And so, systems engineer, marketing and systems engineer. Well, what ends up happening is I could work in the environment with the technical people, and it was usually just guys, because I made people comfortable. And so most of the time you'll find that there will be those individuals who are really, really quiet. And it's because they're so deep in their thoughts. They're thinking things that we couldn't even imagine. And they're not talkative. Well, I'm going to talk you to death. And so what I'm able to do is tell me what it is that we need to do. If you give me the information, I'm quite sure I can decipher whatever that was you just said and make it real plain for those who are trying to sell this network. And I ended up developing really great relationships with the systems engineers because they could give you the most technical, stuff, Gerald. I couldn't even spell the words they were saying, let alone phonetically pronounce them. But I could say, hey, we need to connect A to B, and if we put these pieces together, Joe said he could make it work. Can mm-hmm. we get you to sign this document? And they'd be like, yes. And then, you know, then I'd end up being the one stuck there trying to make sure the network worked. But anyway, did that with IBM for a while. And this is after Richard and I were married. Gerald, I think we thought that I would not be able to have kids. I don't know if every couple goes through that, but I think we went through that mental thought that, okay, I'm not going to have kids. I had had tumors when I was younger. And so we just thought, oh, we're not going to worry about kids. And while I was working, it turns out, guess what? Mm-hmm. I had kids. I don't know how that happened. I don't know what we was doing. But it just happened. I don't know. Maybe because we was married. I don't know. But anyway, we ended up having, I got pregnant. And Gerald, I would tell everybody, from a career standpoint, that was for me, one of the hardest things for me to go through. Because on the one hand, I thought I was going to have this career where I was going to be, as Dr. Mobley said, a complete superstar. And that was my goal, was to be I wanted to be the president of IBM. You couldn't have told me that I wasn't going to be.
Wow, yeah.
And then I came up pregnant. And I had this little thing called Richard III. And, oh, my gosh, you didn't know you could love somebody the way I loved him.
Mm.
And then it's like, you know what? I like him so much. Let's do it again. I don't know what we did. What did we do? Let's do that again. Let's have another one of these.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was pregnant with James. And I remembered as I struggled, Gerald, between my career and because if I'm nothing else, Gerald, I really feel like I'm one of the hardest workers ever. I don't necessarily think I'm the smartest person in the room. I never think that. But I do believe, beyond a shadow of a doubt, I'm one of the hardest workers in the room. I believe in going the extra mile. I believe in taking one more step. I believe in doing one more thing than everybody else. It's my nature. I'm sure it drives my kids crazy. I believe you stay up all night to get the project done because it needs to be done. Your yes is your yes, your no is your no, but we're going to get this done. I remembered, Gerald, the struggle I had, you know, trying to get from work to go pick up Richard III from the babysitter. I got to stay with him for 6 months, and then I went back to work after he was born, and then I was pregnant with James. And, I mean, just getting on, for those of you that know about the Beltway around D.C., that's where we were living, mm-hmm. That Beltway trying to get from, like, Rockville all the way over to Lanham, or Rockville to Greenbelt, because that's where we live, and just being on at 45, OMG,
yep.
It was crazy.
Remember it well.
Well, you remember it well. One day, Gerald, I went to go pick up Richard III. And as we were walking out to the car, picking up from the babysitter, he turned back, and Gail was the best babysitter ever. She loved him. And he turned back and waved back at her, and he said, "Bye, Mama."
Yep.
Gerald, that was a paradigm shift in my life. Because I remembered then, it's like, I'm his mother. And he would call nobody mom but me. And Richard said he just remembered my whole complete demeanor just changed. I didn't even have a conversation with him. I didn't even talk to my husband, Gerald. I just quit.
Yeah, he told us. You hand him the keys to your car.
None of my kids is calling anybody else mama but me. And Gerald, you know, when I think back on it, it's like, how selfish was that of me to do that? It was selfish. It was arrogant. It was inconsiderate of my husband. You know, right now when I think back on it, like how horrible that was. But in that moment, it was like there was nothing else I was going to do. But I was going to raise my kids, me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very important to me when I, you know, just saw things that happened. It's like whatever I could put in them, I had to do that. That had to be my job. And so, as I told you, I'm the hardest worker. So that was my job. And my comment to Richard was, only thing you have to do is get the W-2. I will take care of everything else. Mm-hmm. I take care of the cooking, the cleaning. I'll take care of everything else. I'll raise these kids. I will do everything else. Your job is to go get the W-2. Mm-hmm. And consider getting it direct deposited, please. The check coming in. Yeah. I'm going to need you to direct deposit it. And so, but anyway. So Gerald, that was the complete shift. And then of course he was like, okay, so you know we cannot afford to stay in DC. What are we fixing to do? Miss Daisy. So I was like, okay. Well, what we fixing to do is let's figure out where we can live, where we could afford one salary. And he had always said that before, but you know, I'm a black woman with a job. You ain't gonna tell me I can't go to work and spend my money like I want to. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, like, oh, no, actually, you can't do that. What you're going to do is you have one salary. You need to figure this out. So then Gerald, nothing but God, nothing but God, nothing but God. Richard, within almost 2 weeks, ended up getting a job, was still with the bank. We ended up moving to Houston, Texas. And then once we moved down to Houston, Texas, my job was to raise our kids down there. And so I was an at-home mom that was still very restless. And so I understand I'm the most not at-home mom ever. And so got down to Texas. We got situated. We lived close to his family. I ended up, because I was on leave of absence, the longest leave of absence you've ever heard. I didn't full out quit IBM because I still had all the medical benefits and all of that stuff. So it was really just a leave of absence. I ended up using a lot of my work experience to help other people start small businesses. And so I just remember there's one gentleman, Gary, the sweetest guy. He was my lawn guy. And I remember thinking he was really good at what he does. And I was like, you know what, Gary, we need to expand your business. And he's like, well, what are you talking about? I remember he was speaking with a gentleman at the Walmart. And the gentleman at the Walmart wanted him to come help cut the grass at the Walmart. You don't think about that, right? Depending on where you live, some Walmarts have grass. Like, oh, okay. I guess they have medians and stuff. So he does that work. And I'm like, Gary, we need to look at you doing all the Walmarts. I bet you all these Walmarts around here need that kind of service. And then Gary, I'll help you do that. But the deal is, I don't pay to get my lawn service done. You just come do my lawn and I'll help you build up that business. And so that's how my little entrepreneur Ben started. He ended up with Gerald 73 Walmarts.
Wow.
Doing their lawn stuff. My job was to build the Walmarts for him, and then he would come and do my yard. We had the prettiest yard ever. We always had the most beautiful blossoms, whatever new annuals were coming out. He changed our flowers all the time. And so I think Richard liked that I was doing this kind of thing with individuals. And then Richard didn't have to pay. I would barter services. And he was like, okay, oh my God, I've never seen anybody come up with stuff like that. If I wanted, you know, something new for the house, somebody needed some type of accounting work. Remember that accounting degree that I said I really didn't want to use?
Yeah.
That one. I loved helping people to start things.
Wow.
I love starting things. And so needless to say, whatever we needed something for the house, and I knew I'd be scared to ask him to pay for it, I'd barter for it. You need this kind of service. You need some type of help with your accounting. You need this. Okay. I bet you have a credit card for your business. I need you to go over there and go buy me this bedspread. It's at Dillard's and it's on sale. Can you go get that for me? And I got your accounting done for you. And he would just watch stuff just coming out. He was like, oh, my God. And he was like, Sonia, I'm not going to stop you. Okay. You got it. And so I loved helping people to start things. And so I think my kids got to watch that. I think I wore them out. They're like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
But what they learned, Gerald, was that if they wanted anything done, as Richard would say, they knew to come ask me. Mm-hmm. If they wanted anything, you go ask your mama. And then she'll take care of it. And so, I normally would.
Yeah. That's a fascinating story. and it fits so neatly with when we moved to Charlotte and we met you guys.
Mm-hmm.
It was always your personality and the way for you to draw people in. And you were never, as you said it, you let people feel comfortable. But as I listened to the story of what you did in Houston, in Charlotte, you did the same exact thing. So I'm learning now about you and the work that you do in the community and all the, I guess you could call it social events and things like that. Was that just an outgrowth of that? You continuing on that line of operating?
Yeah. I think what was different in this case, Gerald, was when I got to Charlotte, you know, I don't know anybody. But I don't know a stranger. So I went through the process of meeting people through our church, the Park Church, where the Wright, look, I like to list up all his name, the Wright Reverend Dr. Claude Richard Alexander is pastor. And so
that's right.
We did a lot of things through the church, but I still found myself being very restless. And I began to figure out, well, I could do things with nonprofits. And what was interesting was, it was like when I would do any work with a nonprofit, it was like I had an instant group of friends, right? And I didn't have to necessarily build the relationship. You join the nonprofit, and then I'd have these instant relationships because now I had a concise group of people that I could talk to, share my ideas, and then we could get things done. And I think what I found with the nonprofits is they were always looking for that person who's willing to be the hardest worker. I was that person. So nonprofits actually began to start calling on me. I would say the biggest nonprofit, the biggest and the best nonprofit experience I had was with the Women's Impact Fund. Mm. And with that particular organization, what made it a big deal was I would do a lot of work with nonprofits, and they'd have, you know, the chicken dinners to raise money. And you would buy a ticket for $100. And you would find out later that of that $100 you had given to that organization to help hopefully do good works in the community, $90 of the $100 went to the chicken dinner, the hotel, the band, everything. And it's like, so at the end of the day, I only gave the organization $10. Wow. And that incensed me. And so with the Women's Impact Fund, their model when they got started was there would be 100% of the money you give would go to the nonprofits that we are supporting. And then you had to give an extra amount of money that would go towards administrative expenses. Wow. So when I joined initially, it was, for an example, $1,100. $1,000 went to the nonprofits in the community, and $100 went to the administrative expenses of the organization. Oh, well, I was all bought in. They had just gotten started, and then I remember making the phone call and explaining to them, I want to join your organization. I saw them in the South Park magazine here in Charlotte. And they were like, come on down. We're downtown right off of North Tryon. And when I joined, that particular organization opened up more doors than I ever imagined. Because what I found, Gerald, was, so this was an organization primarily made up of very rich white women who wanted to do really good works in the community. And we had a couple of black women in the group, but what they realized was they were not diverse at all. And they told me when I came in, they're like, Sonia, your job is we want you to help diversify our group. And, I didn't blink. That's not a problem. I knew that I had friends who would be able to participate at that level. We would be able to do the good works. They, I would say, for the most part, had my same work ethic. Like, we have to get the job done. And what the Women's Impact Fund was doing was trying to give impactful, substantial grants of anywhere from $40,000 to $100,000 to five different organizations every year to do good work in the community. So that was really huge to me. That then began to open up a lot of doors when people realized, while on the one hand, I'm clear that God has gifted me to be a leader, it's also clear I will not ask you to do anything that I wouldn't do. And wow. So I'm going to work. If we're going to stay up all night, I'm going to stay up all night. I'm not going to ask you to do more than I would be willing to do. And so what I think began to happen was people then saw, OMG, we found us our little colored worker bee. I felt like that's what I kind of became, a little colored worker bee. And so, but I worked because I really, truly believe, Gerald, in the work that the nonprofits are doing. I really, truly believe in the work that our faith community is doing. We are on the ground floor of We are right there, grassroots, where the work is being done in our communities. So I'm a tremendous supporter of our nonprofits and the work being done in our faith community, because we meet the people where they are.
Right.
And I wanted to support that work. I really wish we did more to support our nonprofits. Hence why I kind of sort of decided to run for political office.
I was gonna get to that. We were gonna talk about that. Well, believe it or not, I'm enjoying this conversation so much. We have like 15 yeah. minutes left.
And, okay.
I'm still, you know, friends are friends are friends. And when I heard that you yes. were going to run, I was like, okay, I kind of can see the personality. I can see the work ethic. I can see all of that. So mm-hmm. help us understand, how did that go from you working in the community, these nonprofits, you're working the church, and then running for political office?
Mm-hmm. Gerald, again, this is another one of those, having gone through the process, I'm telling you, this was nothing but God, because I would not have picked to do this. Let me help everybody be real clear. I would not have picked to do this. One of the number one reasons why is because of my conservative leanings. So for people that may not know this, shock and awe, I'm a Black Republican. Mm-hmm. And it throws so many people, because I think they see the personality of our president. And for some reason, they have decided that that is me. And I have to remind people, when have you ever in this lifetime seen me act like the current leader? I don't.
Right.
I'm not like that. My conservative leanings are biblically based. And there's just, you know, people like, well, that means you don't want change. It's like, no. It's not that I don't want change. What I have seen in my short little lifetime is there are some things that will change and there's some things that won't. And what I have learned, especially working in the nonprofit community, you can't beat people up. You can't argue people into doing something they don't want to do. Mm-hmm. You have to build relationships. And what I see is, when I'm looking at politics currently, is people will not take the time to build the relationships to get things done. Hmm. And it just infuriates me. It's like, this is a conversation. A couple of you go over here to the side and we're going to discuss. You would like this. I would like this. What can we do to help one another to get done what we need to get done? And then we're going to come out of this room holding hands, singing Kumbaya. We're going to get this work done. I have always worked that way, Gerald. For me, I know there are people, they get more entrenched into the policies and the procedures and this legislation. And they get all caught up to me and all that minutia of all that talk that at the end of the day means nothing for us or for our people. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you just look in your hand, did I get it or did I not? Mm-hmm. And that's really how I operate. It's either A or B. I'm very black and white. I know there's a lot of gray you have to work through. But at the end of the day, did I get what I wanted or did I not? And I think a lot of people have not, or have just gotten past the art of the negotiation. The mm-hmm. art of the compromise. For some reason, those are bad words. And God willing, and the creek don't rise, I want to bring that back. It's like, you all, it's like a marriage. It's, you work through this. It is not my way or the highway. It's, what can I do to help you? What would you like? This is what I would like. Mm-hmm. And now, how can we compromise to see what we can do to make each other happy? You may not get 100% of what you want. But if we can work on something, I can make sure you walk away from this happy, and I can walk away from this happy, and we are a happy whole. And I think it is clear we have gotten away from that in this country. It's just so divisive. It's like, there's got to be some of us who are willing to step forward mm-hmm. and put it all on the line. And I decided, you know what, Gerald, I can't talk about it. I got to be about it. So you know what? Let me go out here. let me catch these here bullets and arrows that are coming my direction for standing up and saying, I won't even say a politician, but I'm a Republican, I'm black, I'm female, but let's call it first. I'm black, mm-hmm. I'm female, I'm Christian, I'm Republican. I've chosen those things. Now, what can I do? What can I bring to the table to make some things work? And I think one of the things, Gerald, I'll say this to people, and it kind of throws them off. And I guess I want to say this without being controversial, but I don't know, maybe it sounds controversial, maybe it doesn't. White people are on both sides of the political aisle. They are Democrats and they are Republicans. In fact, they got some other parties, the Constitution Party, Reform Party, the Green Party, the American Conservation Party. They got all these parties. What they can't get done on one side of the aisle, they will get done on the other side of the aisle. What they can't get done on the Democratic side of the aisle, they will get done on the Republican side of the aisle. It's called being pragmatic. Mm-hmm. What I want black people, and I want my Latino brothers and sisters, I want my Asian brothers and sisters, I need them to all understand we have got to get on both sides of the aisle. It is called the art of war. In order to be successful, you have to have all kinds of strategies in place. You can't attack a problem from only one side. You got to get on all the sides and then figure out what are the strategies that I could use to get done what I need to get done. For black people to achieve that, in my personal opinion, we've got to get on every side of the table to figure out what are policies and legislation that are beneficial to us. Unless we're in the room, we will get nothing done. So for all of you that like Hamilton, he told y'all, you got to be in the room where the deals are happening. Mm-hmm. And so if we're not in the room where the conversations are being held, how do we know what's going on? We can't just keep pushing from only one side of the table and expect change. We have to be able to get in all parts of the room. And we also have to understand, I can't do what I do the same way you do what you do. God put you in your space for a reason. You have a skill set to get done what you know how to get done. I'm over here on this side. I can't do it the way you want me to do it. I can get done what needs to get done the way God has structured me to do it, which then means, so what are the ways that Republicans take care of business? I have to operate in that same arena, the way that they operate, and then allow me to be effective at getting stuff done. So mm-hmm. for those who have watched me and seen me over all these years, Gerald, what they will have to say is, I am very effective, and I get done what I say I'm going to get done. I've been able to do that my whole life. I've had to, depending on what situation you're in. If I mentioned before, I grew up with parents that were addicts. And depending mm-hmm. on the situation that I'm in, I had to assess the entire situation around me. Now, what is going to be the best and effective way for me to get done what I need to get done? I feel like God has blessed me with my ability to do that. So in running for this office, even though I didn't win the first time,
right.
What people may not realize is the number of relationships, Gerald, that I've built. And when people saw my numbers and how effective I was, even the Republican Party here in Charlotte was shock and awed when they saw how well I did. They were like, oh, my goodness. And so, Gerald, my little phone has just been ringing off the hook. Because now everybody's like, okay, Sonia, what are we getting ready to do next? What are we getting ready to do? What are we getting ready to do? And it's like, you all, you know, it was the one step. Now, I ain't going to lie. You know, from the words of the prophet Mike Tyson, everybody got a plan till they get punched in the face. I got punched in the face, Gerald. So my little tooth is hanging right now, and I got to get my little tooth pushed back up, and I got my little eye swollen a little bit because, you know, I don't lose. But what God is helping me to see that this was just a step. I needed to be able to get in the ring, and I learned, Gerald, that I could take the punches. And so, you know, it just kind of reminds me of, you know, I think of David, right? when he was, you know, God told him he was going to be the king. Man, it took a long time for him to go back and forth with Saul before he could finally take his rightful position.
Right.
And so what I realized is I got to be able to do the fight. So in the process of what it is that God wants me to ultimately do with this, I'm making relationships, and I'm hoping that I can now take those relationships that I have established in this process to build something else that's for our community. And it's just not just for Black people, but for white people and Latinos, for Asians, for everyone that's around us. It's like, you guys, I guess, Gerald, I don't look necessarily at this as, well, this is politics. What I'm looking at is, so what is a vehicle that I can use to get things done for us? What is a vehicle that I could use that can get things done for, you know, for Charlotte, for North Carolina? And I have built relationships that I really believe will help me to be very effective. And so people won't see them, may not see them now, but give me a few minutes, boo. Once I get this tooth tucked back in and I get my face all shined back up, get my makeup back on, I promise you, we're all going to see what God had planned. I didn't expect it to turn out this way, but I promise you, God's got something big planned, and it's going to blow everybody's mind. And I'm just kind of like, because I'm still sitting like, okay, Daddy, my eyes still hurt. But I'm going to if you want me to go back out here, I'm going.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me, because when I heard that you were going to run, and then I heard the party affiliation, you know, I said to myself, it's going to be interesting, because everyone that knows you would have thought differently. But, you know, that's who you are. That's who you are. And we love you for it. We're at almost a time, but I want to do with you what we've done with all our guests. The purpose of this podcast is to inspire our young people, young professionals. People will hear your story, you know, being the child of addicts and growing up in, you know, bi-coastal with grandparents and aunts and uncles, and your successes in your school, your master's, your marriage, everything rolling all the way up. If you had, in the remaining 2 to 3 minutes that we have, words of encouragement and inspiration for these young people, young professionals, and even some seasoned saints, I would say, what would be some words of encouragement and inspiration you would have in this post-COVID, or in this COVID, soon to be post-COVID, we hope, environment, where people seem to be a little bit out of sort, just waiting to see what's going to happen next?
Gerald, oh my goodness, that's a very loaded question, because I have a lot of things I could say. But given that I have a limited time, here's a couple of things. You all, we have got to, one, get back to God. God is very clear about everything that is happening and everything that is going on. He's completely aware. And I don't think people understand, those of us that are able to get through this, that God has now presented us with an opportunity to see some magnificent things happen. You know, we hear about pandemics and all kinds of stuff that we've read about in history. We are getting to live through one of the biggest history lessons in modern times. We're actually living through this. We are living through COVID. We're alive to see this. We are living through the most contentious political session that we have ever seen in our lifetime. We are getting to live through this and see this. We have the whole expansion of the Black Lives Matter movement. We are alive to actually see this. We are living through history. They're going to write about this in history. We actually get to live through it and see it. And I don't know if you can see my excitement about it. Like, you guys, we are a part of history. OMG, we're going to be the ones that get to tell this story. Everyone, we're going to be able to say, and this is how I made it through. And this is how, this is my testimony. And this is what we were going through. And I got through it. I want people to see the excitement in you are now a part of one of the greatest historic movements that we will ever see in our lifetime. You know, we get to see the, you know, Holocaust victims and what they went through, and when they tell their story, and you almost feel like you're right there because of the passion and the energy they have around. They lived through that history, and we are living through this history. And so my prayer is that people will take this in and be strengthened by it. What I really want to tell, especially our young Black brothers and sisters, y'all, I'm gonna need y'all to toughen up. I'm gonna need y'all to get some backbones around here. My biggest concern is, like, do y'all know that we lived through slavery and got through? We went through lynchings and beatings and rapes. We have gone through so much. Right now is not the time for us to be walking around here sulking with our heads down, feeling sad for ourselves. Our ancestors were some of the strongest people in history, and they got through. That's what we are made of. That's what we are full of. God is with us. Even in these trying times, even in these hard times, God is with us. We have lived through some stuff. We have gone through some stuff that nobody can ever say that they or their ancestors ever went through. And so when I look at Black folks, I'm like, y'all, Gerald, I ain't going to cuss on your little show, but I'm telling you, Richard has to stop me every now and then, but he ain't here to stop me today. But Gerald, I need us to get our backbones back. Mm-hmm. And I need us to stand up and say, we are a people who have transcended so much, and God has brought us through. This little stuff we're going through right now, y'all, this is nothing. This is nothing compared to what our ancestors went through. We can get through this. So when you are going to work, don't look for the microaggressions. Don't let those things detract from you. Yeah, they're there. They always going to be there. You know what racism is going to be? Racism is always going to be there because that's a heart matter. And until all of us get ourselves lined back up with God Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and give ourselves over to his son, Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, and we listen to the Holy Spirit who wants to lead us and guide us, if we would allow him, our lives would be so much better if we would do just that. That's, and then I just wish we could get back to that. And so what gears me up, what puffs me up, is I know God has got me. Yeah. And I may not like what I'm going through, but if you read your Bible, I tell people, y'all need to go read the old prophets, the Old Testament prophets.
Right.
And look at the stuff we went through. Y'all, we can do this. We can do this.
Indeed we can. And thank you so much. You know, it's always, you could hear the passion and excitement in your voice. And that is definitely the Sonya Nichols that we all know. Well, my dear friend, we're at time, and I want to say to our guests that another hour has gone by, and we have spent time with Ms. Sonya Nichols on today, and I hope that something was shared, something was said, something was, you know, revealed today that will give us all pause for us to consider ways to get things done. So, ladies and gentlemen, that does it for us this week on this episode of It's Easy Son. Your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. And I want to thank Mrs. Nichols for being with us today. And until next week, remember, it's easy, son. And quit making things so difficult. Until next time, have a great week, and we'll be back in touch. Take care and stay safe.